May it please the court. This case alleging libel arose out of the 1985 campaign for mayor in the city of South Houston. Mr. Brasher, who was the plaintiff below, was the incumbent mayor. Mr. Thiel, one of the defendants, was his opponent. Mr. Walter Carr, the other defendant, was a citizen of the city of South Houston and a supporter of Mr. Thiel in his race against Mr. Brasher. During the course of the campaign, Mr. Carr wrote and Mr. Thiel published a series of campaign brochures. The brochures were brightly colored. They contained colorful and provocative rhetoric about the campaign. They contained campaign slogans that readily identified them as campaign literature, and they were reasonably identifiable by any reasonable reader as such. The record reflects that this was an intense and sometimes bitter campaign. The record reflects that the incumbent mayor, Mr. Brasher, on at least one or more occasions challenged those who disagreed with him to fistfights in council chambers. It is fair to infer from the record, I suggest, that Mr. Brasher was no stranger to confrontation and controversy. It was against this backdrop, then, that Citizen Carr began to write his campaign pamphlets, and Mr. Thiel began to publish those pamphlets, criticizing the incumbent administration. There are, within the four brochures in question, approximately 282 statements. And it is those statements that I want to address first in what I believe to be four different categories, for analysis' sake, into which they fall. Most of the statements I submit are statements of opinion. Some of those statements of opinion also contain assertions of fact. But all of the statements can be broken down, I suggest, into four categories. First are those statements that are conceded to be true by Mr. Brasher. Second are those statements that, even if there is evidence that they may have been false, are such that they cannot, as a matter of law, be defamatory. Third are those statements constituting, in all likelihood, most of the statements that are in fact statements of opinion that are constitutionally protected under the First Amendment. And in the fourth category are those statements that, even if they are alleged to be defamatory, cannot, in the context of these brochures and in the context of this political campaign, be such as to be shown that they were made with actual malice. Let me talk first about the first category, that is, the statements that are conceded to be true. And I'll focus on three of the statements singled out by the Court of Civil Appeals below. Those three statements are identified as 1, 2, and 3 on the exhibit, and concerned the statements about Mr. Brasher hiring certain friends to do the grass cutting for the city. The statements are that Brasher paid four of his friends $34,328 for grass mowing, all paid by taxpayers. Let us see if cronyism and more is involved. The second statement, and do you know that while the city gave $34,328 to Brasher's cohorts, that the city only collected $11,042. He only lost $23,285.50 on his payoffs. And the third statement, how many of you made $11,150 as Charles Powell did on a sunny Saturday or Sunday in addition to regular employment? With respect to the factual assertions in those three statements, those assertions that are clearly factual, that is, the payments of the money and the receipt of the money, those statements are admitted by Brasher. Brasher, in his affidavit, admits that he hired four of his friends to mow the grass, that they were paid the $34,000, that the city collected only the $11,000, and that $23,000 was still uncollected and carried on the books as an account receivable. Now, the inferences to be drawn and the opinions in those same statements I will address in a moment, but at least insofar as specific facts, those statements or those assertions that are clearly factual, there is no dispute. In the second category are statements, and there are a number of them, that even if they were false, they could not, as a matter of law, be defamatory. For example, the statement that $94,000 was to be spent on a dog pound, the statement that the Brasher administration was spending $385,000 to build a jail, the statement that $30,000 was being spent to restore a police building, the statement that there were shortages in the budget, the statement that Brasher advocated the building of 22 jail cells instead of a lesser number. Those statements, even if there is evidence that they are incorrect or that the amounts are incorrect, cannot, as a matter of law, be defamatory. The third category are those statements, and they constitute, I submit, most of the statements in the brochures, are statements of opinion that are entitled to absolute protection under the First Amendment. Turning again to these same three statements that the Court of Civil Appeals focused on, it is clear, I submit, under the Ullman test, which is the test that has been adopted by the court below as well as the El Paso Court of Civil Appeals, is the test setting up a four-part inquiry to determine whether or not certain statements are fact or whether they are constitutionally protected statements of opinion. The Ullman case, of course, is the D.C. Circuit case that has been widely regarded as the leading case in deciding what is constitutionally protected opinion. The first inquiry under that four-part test is whether or not the statement has a precise meaning that is likely to give rise to clear factual implications, or, on the other hand, whether it is so loosely definable and variously interpretable that it can only be an opinion. The Ullman case, for example, cites the case brought by William F. Buckley, a political writer criticized William F. Buckley, calling him in a column, quote, a fellow traveler of fascists, unquote. The Second Circuit held that because that statement was not one capable of having a precise meaning, that it was protected, and that, quote, tremendous imprecision of the meaning and usage of those terms in the realm of political debate, unquote, is protected. With respect, for example, to the word payoff, which is one of the words focused on by the Court of Civil Appeals, that word is clearly capable, even by the admission of the Court of Civil Appeals, as having more than one meaning. It may, in fact, mean simply, as I believe was intended in the context here, to be a political reward for cronies that he hired to do work for the city. And if, in fact, it is, as I believe it is, a term loosely definable and variously interpretable, it is more likely to be an opinion rather than a fact. Under the second part of the Ullman test, the court inquires whether the statement is objectively capable of proof or disproof, that is, easily verifiable or not. Looking at the word cohort, which is another one of the words focused on by the Court of Civil Appeals, that word clearly is one that is not easily verifiable. Whether one is a friend or an associate or a cohort is not the kind of easily verifiable statement or statement that is capable of a precise meaning that is more likely to be a fact rather than opinion. Cohort is simply a more colorful characterization of associate or friend, but is nevertheless more opinion-laden than fact-laden. The third inquiry focused on by the Ullman Court is to examine the context in which the statement appears. The Ullman Court, for example, said, and I'm quoting, the language of the entire column may signal that a specific statement which, standing alone, would appear to be factual is in actuality a statement of opinion, end of quote. And the fourth inquiry that the Ullman Court directs us to is to examine the broader social context into which the statement fits. That is, again quoting Ullman, it is one thing to be assailed as a corrupt public official by a soapbox orator, and quite another to be labeled corrupt in a research monogram detailing the causes and cures of corruption in public service. I would suggest that no reasonable reader of these brochures, particularly when on the cover they carry statements like, vote your conscience and throw the rascal and his puppets out, and we can elect a mayor who is polite and friendly and return this city to a position of respect and responsibility by voting on April 6, 1985 and electing a new mayor. Any reasonable reader reading those statements on the cover of the brochures would have to be alerted that this is political opinion, that this is political campaign literature, and it is clearly distributed under the undisputed record in this case in the midst of a very heated and hard-fought campaign for office.
As a matter of law. It has to be as a matter of law for you to prevail in this circumstance.
As the opinion,
yes,
to test, that is correct.
Does that mean that cohort could never be defamatory?
No. It does not mean that.
Why isn't there a fact question whether it is in this circumstance?
Because the question, Your Honor, as to whether or not speech is a constitutionally protected opinion as distinguished from a fact is a matter of law. For example, in the United States Supreme Court case of Greenbelt Publishing against Bressler, the developer in that case was accused in a public hearing of blackmailing the city. The developer was attempting to get a zoning variance. And in a public hearing, the developer was accused of attempting to blackmail the city into getting what it wanted. The plaintiff prevailed in the lower court, claiming, of course, that blackmail was a term that implied criminal conduct and that therefore he had been accused of criminal conduct. The United States Supreme Court reversed, holding that in that context, as a matter of constitutional law, the word blackmail in these circumstances was not liable when reported. So that the context of the statement, if we look at the Supreme Court cases in Greenbelt, letter of carriers is another, is all important. That same word the court acknowledges in another context could be defamatory.
Such as a commercial context.
Absolutely.
Does the Ullman Court ever talk specifically about political campaigns? Or do you find anything in the cases that would single out statements by a candidate or his or her supporters during a campaign as entitled to a higher degree of First Amendment protection?
Ullman, I think, fairly interpreted, has to mean that. One of the statements that I referred to earlier, for example, is, and this is directly out of Ullman, it is one thing to be assailed as a corrupt public official by a soapbox orator, and quite another to be labeled corrupt in a research monogram detailing the causes and cures of corruption in public service. That case arose, of course, factually, that is the Ullman case, as a result of an Evans and Novak column criticizing a liberal professor as being a Marxist professor and going on to state that he had no standing in the community, that is, no reputation in the community. So the case arose at least not in a political campaign setting, but in a political setting to the extent that Evans and Novak clearly are political commentators, and the court, it seems to me, went out of its way to stress the context in trying to arrive at that decision.
Any other cases on the whole theory of opinion as absolute protection? Sent off into political campaigns and give you, I guess, broader leeway to interpret facts as opinion when you are in the context of a procedure that is so much at the heart of the democratic process?
I think the letter carrier's case, the United States Supreme Court case, is helpful in that regard. That is the case that arose out of a very bitter labor dispute. Three non-union employees were accused by the union of being scabs, were labeled as being traitors to their God, their country, their family, and their class. The plaintiffs in that case obviously alleged the allegation of traitor is an accusation of treason, a high crime. The court in that case was careful to emphasize that in this case, in the context of a labor union dispute, that term traitor is deployed in a, quote, loose and figurative sense, unquote, and could not be taken for the assertion that employees committed the criminal offense of treason. The court, it seems to me, seems to be saying that as we move closer and closer to pure political disputes, language is more likely to be construed as opinion rather than fact. And I think that that is what Ullman is trying to get at. And in fact, in part of the opinion, the Ullman court stresses that, in fact, it is that third and fourth element that may in fact be the beginning part of the analysis. That is, we look first at the context, the broad context in which the statements are made, next in the context of the actual brochure itself in which the statement is contained.
Counselor, are you going to speak about Adam versus Liberty Lobby and Malice and how we can engage perhaps
I would like to, and I'll address that now, and I'm mindful of the fact that I have promised Mr. Schmeiser some time, so I will try to answer that and then perhaps in rebuttal address it again, Your Honor. If the statements taken as a whole are constitutionally protected opinion, as I believe they are, the issue of malice need not be reached. If, however, there are statements which may in fact be alleged to be defamatory, in which an issue of fact is raised in that regard, then it is our position that such statements as a matter of law have not been shown to have been made with actual malice. Anderson, in our view, applies to the state courts by virtue of the First Amendment. The state courts are split on that matter. At last count, last week, there appeared to be 7 state court cases indicating that Anderson was based upon the First Amendment, 2 of those at least clearly holding that, the other 5 indicating that. One case, a case out of Alaska, stating that Anderson was based upon the federal rule, and 6 cases in which Anderson is cited with approval, but it is not clear from the opinion as to whether they are indicating that it is based on the First Amendment or on procedure. In any event, whether it is constitutionally based or based on a rule of federal procedure, I think that Anderson at the very least stands for the proposition that a message is being sent to state courts that their summary judgment procedure should at least accommodate those First Amendment rights at the summary judgment level in the same manner so as to protect the rights just as they are protected in the federal court. In other words, the outcome ought not to be different depending on whether you are in federal court or state court. And I think Briggs, in fact, accommodates those rights.
Let me ask back up here. You can pick out some part of Anderson and reach whatever conclusion you want. I think that's probably every litigant would disagree with that, but that's my view. So we're going to have to guess off whether it's First Amendment based or not. If it is not First Amendment based, first question, is there anything that would require the state of Texas even to have a summer procedure. And I don't think there is, because we didn't have one 50 years ago. If there's not anything that requires us to have a First Amendment procedure, is there anything short of Anderson being constitutionally required that would say that if we have one, it must be set up like the federal government sets theirs up in this particular type of case?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, would you say that we have to, if this case goes to a jury, under Sullivan and its progeny, submit this on a clear and convincing standard to the jury?
Absolutely.
We no longer have a choice to use preponderance of the evidence.
That is absolutely correct.
All right, if that's the case, is there anything that would require our summary judgment procedure to be set up on a clear and convincing standard, or could we put it at a lesser standard?
Well, that obviously is at the heart of the debate between the majority and the dissent in Anderson. I think, as a practical matter, that if Briggs is interpreted correctly by us, Briggs resolves that problem. Briggs says that once defendant comes forward with more than a mere self-serving affidavit and comes forward with some objective explanation of what occurred, and the plaintiff had an opportunity to rebut that testimony, that at that point, absent a showing of clear and convincing evidence of malice, the defendant should prevail. I guess what I'm saying is that it seems to me that if Briggs is read to mean what we think it means, it answers the matter discussed in Anderson.
Briggs, as I recall, specifically accepts out whether Besant and Smith remain viable or not. Is there any way that can remain good law and you prevail on this appeal? Will we have to overrule those two?
I don't think so, because again, as I read Bisson and Beaumont Enterprise, in those cases, the majority took pains to point out that the only evidence that the defendant brought forward was the self-serving affidavit. Here, there is much more. There is a very detailed 7-hour deposition of Mr. Carr in which he painstakingly explains each and every source, detailing the nature of the source and the nature of the information obtained, and there is no evidence rebutting or impeaching any of those sources or the statements in there. And I think in that regard it is similar to Briggs.
So we have extrinsic evidence raising a negation of malice. Like in Briggs, you had an explanation for why the tape was messed up. Here you have an explanation for how the state of mind arose.
That's correct.
You put enough detail into it.
That's correct. And for 7 hours, the state of mind of Walter Carr was examined, and if there was, in fact, evidence to rebut that or to impeach that, there is no indication the plaintiff did not have the opportunity to do so.
How does that differ from the affidavit, though? If what was in the deposition is put in affidavit form, this court has said it doesn't get you there. You cannot negate an absent state of mind by self-serving declaration. And I'm sure that the deposition were a lot of self-serving statements about purity of heart.
Two distinctions, I think. First, in Bisson and Beaumont Enterprises, the self-serving statement was to the effect, there is no malice. Statement's not false. I didn't state it intentionally in any event, and there certainly was no reckless disregard with respect to whether it's true or false. End of statement. In Briggs, there was a detailed explanation beyond that. That is factual statements of I talked to Mr. A and I talked to Mr. B and I verified that was C.
But the listener, that opinion was a technical difficulty, a technical malfunction, and the court specifically stated we were not going to address the applicability of Anderson versus Liberty Law.
Right.
So I think the way I would bridge the court, my brothers on this court do not agree with me, things on the technical malfunction as the reason for the propriety of the summary judgment.
And I guess, in fairness, having read your concurrence, I think that your concurrence is a fair statement of what the majority was in effect doing. I know that You were not joined in that, but I think that Briggs does not depart in any way, for example, from Houston against Clear Creek, the traditional summary judgment law. That is, if the defendant brings forward sufficient evidence to establish the defense as a matter of law, then it's still up to the plaintiff to raise a fact issue. So I think that the language seized upon in your concurrence from the majority opinion, that is, the fact that the plaintiff had full and fair opportunity to rebut, is the key. I mean, what we are concerned about here, or ought to be concerned about here, is whether or not there is any evidence, or will ever be any evidence, from the plaintiff to raise an issue of malice. And if we have overcome the problem of giving the plaintiff full and fair opportunity to come forward with whatever evidence he has or will ever have, and there is none, then we ought to, at summary judgment stage, particularly in the First Amendment area, act on it. And I say that as the lawyer who ordinarily represents plaintiffs. I am not offended by the proposition that I should at some point have to come forward with some evidence to establish my case. And I think that the message in part from Anderson, whether directly binding or not, is let's look very carefully at the summary judgment stage, let's give the plaintiff full and fair opportunity to bring whatever evidence he has, but let's resolve it then and there. And I need to, before my co-counsel attacks me, let him have a few minutes. Thank you.
About 2 minutes, yeah.
May it please the court, I represent Petitioner Al Teal, and in the limited time I have here, I will jump what I plan to say and try to address what I perceive to be the concerns of the court. First, with respect to Justice Heck's question regarding the opinion versus meaning distinction, the distinction is this. Opinion is a question and a matter of U.S. constitutional law. Whether or not a statement is constitutionally protected is a matter of law. It is not a matter of fact. The question of whether or not a statement is capable of a defamatory meaning is initially a question of law for the court. If the court determines that the statement is ambiguous or is capable of a defamatory meaning, it is then a question of fact. It is our position, of course, that taken in context, these statements are statements of opinion. Constitutionally protected, it is not an issue that should ever be submitted to the jury. Secondly, with respect to Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, it is the position of Petitioner Teal that regardless of whether the court requires respondent to bring forward clear and convincing evidence of actual malice, that Petitioner Teal is entitled to summary judgment on the facts of this case. Petitioner Teal simply reprinted these brochures. There is no sponsorship on his part. His name does not appear anywhere on these brochures. He did not edit the material. He did not alter the material. He simply reprinted what was brought to him.
Is a printer entitled to a different standard of protection in the courts than, say, a journalist who takes a statement and rebroadcasts it?
Arguably, yes, Your Honor. And in fact, that is the basis for the privilege of accurate republication, which we also bring forward in our brief in this case. Actually, that would apply to a reporter as well as a printer. That privilege simply says that there is a First Amendment value that attaches to statements by public figures and public officials wholly independent of whether or not the republisher himself or herself has any animus, actual malice, whatever their state of mind is. The example
so
I give...
If you're really out to get somebody, you say it yourself, you can be tagged for big damages, but if you can find somebody else, get them to say it, and then just... rebroadcast that, you go home scot free.
If it is a public official or public figure making statements about another public official or public figure, those are the parameters
you
of the...
You mean that I, as a public official, get more rights to defame somebody? Now, if I want to defame one of these justices, I will get off freer than if somebody who's not a public figure
to do so? Well, Your Honor, of course, actual malice standard applies if you are defaming another public figure or public official. But no, absolutely not. What I'm talking about, the privilege of accurate republication, applies only to the republisher, to the person accurately republishing your defamatory statements, because presumably the voters and citizens of the state have an interest in knowing whatever you say about some other public official. That interest of the public in being informed about what you say supersedes any animus, or lack of animus indeed, that the republisher may have toward the object of the defamation.
We'll hear from you again on the rebuttal. We're ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, the applicant and Linda Fowles present arguments and respondents.
May it please the court. The Texas Constitution states that every person shall be at liberty to speak, write, or publish his opinions on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that privilege. The court today is in a position to set a standard in the state of Texas that would reaffirm Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution while still protecting the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Section 8 doesn't say that only private citizens will be protected. It doesn't say that. Clearly, a person running for public office has the same protection absent the First Amendment protection that we've already heard talked about. Nor does it say that any person may tell a lie or half-truths or juxtapositions to create the implication and the inference in the mind of the reader that it is a truth, such that it creates a defamatory or injurious meaning. On the contrary, the very foundation of Article 1 was the recognition of the importance of the search for truth. And that's why Article 1 was written in the Texas Constitution. That's why it was written in the United States Constitution as the First Amendment. We're well aware that the freedom of speech and the freedom of press are not absolute rights, and that there are restrictions, and there are competing interests, however. And the state of Texas has an interest in ensuring that the public can believe what they hear, and that public officials or candidates running for public office aren't subjected to the type of defamatory statements that Walter Carr published and Al Thiel printed about Lynn Brasher. 40 years ago in the Fitzgerald case, the court stated that it's the policy of the state of Texas to give every citizen the right to defend his reputation and good name from libelous publications, and this right is zealously protected.
I mean, you can see that the First Amendment is the floor.
Yes, I
do. The rights of a person.
Yes, I do.
To make a public statement.
Yes,
and,
I do.
And that's a pretty high floor now.
That's correct. It is.
So there's really no need to go back to a 1948 or 49 Texas case, anything prior to Sullivan. And public figure defamation is really just a museum piece.
That's correct. But the Texas Constitution. What you said earlier about if Anderson versus Liberty Lobby is just a purely summary judgment standard rather than expanding the traditional First Amendment protection, if you take that back to Texas, well, do we have to have a summary judgment rule? I think the answer is no, and what Texas does have is another section of the Constitution that protects the individual and gives a student, an individual a right to a trial by jury. So we go back to what are the individual rights. It's always been a competing interest, Your Honor. Even the constitutional ramifications of the First Amendment have competing interests, that the individual not be defamed, that if it is a public official and then the Sullivan standard of actual malice comes into play.
Do you agree that the Sullivan standard applies in this case?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
If you get to the jury, then you accept you'll have to prove this case by clear and convincing evidence.
That's correct.
Is there any reason then, since we do have a summary judgment procedure in Texas, not to put that same clear and convincing burden into the summary judgment? In other words, it's an awkward thing to those of us who think of preponderance all the time, but we may find you have enough evidence to get to the jury in a negligence case, say, but that quantum of evidence may constitute no evidence in terms of being able to prove a clear and convincing purpose.
Well, I think the reason is that we do have a right to a trial by jury. And while that hasn't been held to defeat summary judgment, I understand that. What it does do is give us the additional protections in the state of Texas. When we have the judges start deciding a quantum and quality of the evidence, rather than has the respondent produced some evidence to defeat the absence of actual malice. When we start doing that, then we're taking away that right of Mr. Brasher.
So you say it's constitutionally protected to allow you to go to the jury with some evidence, even if the court feels that there will be that could never, that a directed verdict would always be proper in the case because you couldn't reach clear and convincing. We might get in a Mandela that lasts forever.
Well, the difference is, of course, that at the directed verdict stage, the court has already been able to view the credibility of the witnesses. And what we've got here is an unending litigation of a paper trial, as I think the dissent in the Anderson versus Liberty Lobby case said. What you're going to have is the judges, each litigant is going to put on a full-blown trial on paper, and the judge will rule on the credibility of witnesses by looking at a piece of paper.
Would a directed verdict in this case be proper if the trial court found that the plaintiff had not proved defamation by clear and convincing evidence, by actual malice, by clear and convincing evidence?
I think that's correct. I think on the evidence that Mr. Brasher has put forth at this stage, you could choose to adopt the Liberty Lobby standard and he would still prevail. You know, I feel that the evidence that has been presented is enough not only to defeat Texas summary judgment, Texas directed verdict, but also the federal standards that's
now. My question is a little different, though. Would a directed verdict be proper if the trial court found that you had not proved actual malice by clear and convincing evidence?
I think that's what the courts currently do, yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't the same standard applied for summary judgment as for directed verdict?
And that goes back to what I just said. I think that, of course, the standard is the same, except that the difference is in timing and the judging of the credibility of the witnesses.
Aren't we running headlong into the dicta about the... I agree with you. There's some very serious... There's three sections of our Constitution, Article 8, 13, either 15 or 16, 15. At least that give very strong protection to a defamation plaintiff, but... Aren't we running headlong into a lot of U.S. Supreme Court language about the chilling effect of a very trial process on First Amendment free exercise? If we're setting up a standard here that virtually guarantees a trial when there's no chance that plaintiff can prevail at the trial. In other words, we're sentencing somebody to say, your First Amendment protections are such that you will win a trial, but for exercising the First Amendment, you now have won the right to a 3-year defense of the case. Isn't there a chilling effect there that at least some federal cases that indicated reaches constitutional dimensions?
I think that there are some cases that have discussed that. I don't think that's the case. I think that the Texas standard does protect the defendant as it currently stands. Because
I'm again talking about rights and conflict.
Well, you know, clearly there are competing interests, and I guess what I would argue is that we're not denigrating or limiting the First Amendment protection, and clearly the state of Texas can't do that. But the state of Texas can, while enforcing the First Amendment standards, can give its individual citizens the rights that they have under their own constitution.
Under your position, can a defendant ever get a summary judgment in a Sullivan defamation case?
Yes. In the Briggs case, that is what happened. Now, as Justice Gonzalez says, didn't the court actually adopt the Anderson versus Liberty Lobby standard? I don't think...
Yeah, the eight members of this court don't think we did. We think there was. Everybody else in the room feels differently, but eight judges felt that there was an independent technological explanation for this, apart from getting into anybody's head, so that we didn't have to look at Liberty Lobby, we didn't have to look at Bessant, we didn't have to look at Smith. But that all put away to a later day, and I believe it's expressly in the opinion that it all awaits a later day, and a later day is today.
It's today.
The problem with that is, the court wouldn't, Ray, let's just say that the ample time for discovery was pressing the case.
Let me address that issue, if I might. And I read that opinion. Of course, I didn't go back and look at the court records in that case, but the opinion stated, I believe, that the case languished for 2 years or sat there for 2 years and no discovery by plaintiff was done. That's not the case here. And although Mr. Midoff said several times that this case has been fully developed, that is not the case here. As we briefed in our argument, this case was set for trial within, I think it's 2 months of actual the filing date or the service of the party. We went to a pretrial conference. The judge asked for summary judgment motions. I tried to take depositions. The defendants kept putting me off, couldn't meet, couldn't do it. I noticed them a couple of times. Finally, only 10 days before summary judgment response was due, did I get to take that 7-hour deposition of Walter Carr.
Did you make a motion under Rule 166 for further time?
No, I did not, Your Honor. And
we would have to presume that it's adequate time, you know, in the absence of such a motion.
That may be true, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. But no, I did not pursue that. But nevertheless, we took those depositions. All we had were two depositions, Walter Carr's and Al Field. And during the deposition, every question that was asked as to state of mind, Mr. Carr and Mr. Thiel answered with their standard affidavit statement. I didn't do anything that I thought would seriously injure the plaintiff. And I agree, I think it was you, Justice Gonzalez, that said, isn't the deposition question or issue the same as the affidavit issue? I think it is, because there is no extrinsic evidence from that deposition. It is simply Walter Carr stating what he believes and what serves his best interest. I think that there are some other issues.
Are you going to address whether or not these statements are libelous in the first place? Because the challenge, these statements are not libelous because they're opinions or they're facts, which have been conceded. Yeah. Therefore, we never get to the balance question. Are you going to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether or not I think these are libelous, sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, absolutely. Now, these are not the only statements in the four brochures, and you saw the brightly colored brochures. There are several things that I think are happening. Number one, there are statements of fact that are simply untrue, and Lynn Brasher refuted and controverted those statements in his affidavit. Some of those statements, while in and of themselves, even though untrue, may not have a defamatory meaning, given the context in which they are stated, make them defamatory. For example, the statement I believe that he has up here that you only lost $23,285 on his payoff. Well, first of all, payoff does have a negative connotation of giving money for something not earned. And the $23,000, while that in itself may be an accurate figure of the amount of money that had not yet been collected, it was under collection. And Mr. Brasher controverted that and said, I didn't pay anybody off. I paid legitimate business people for their legitimate work. It wasn't work done on one Sunday afternoon. It was work done over a period of months.
These type of the responses that are made in any political campaign, charges and countercharges?
Some of them are very similar, and some of them look like purely political debate. But what Walter Carr did was say, let's look at the truth. And he highlighted truth on practically every brochure. He'd say, let's look at the facts and the record. So he's telling the reader, and these are 4,500 brochures mailed to every citizen in the city of South Houston. And he's telling these readers, I am an independent person. Here I am, Mr. Attorney. I'm not one of your politicos. I'm giving you the facts and the truth.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
basically sitting here, we're going to give you taxes in this administration. I guarantee you that. Now, is that truth, or is that fact, fiction, or where does it fit in?
Well, there is a difference, though. There's a difference in the way he juxtaposed the truths and the untruths. There's a difference in the way he presented it to the reader. He presented it as, this is a fact that is easily verifiable. We can't verify George Bush's Read My Lips. We can verify...
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Some videotape.